Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and this is Carl from Deviant Legion, and of course, Incredibly Strange Films and Film and Stuff. And we are very, very happy to focus on one of the great female sexploitation directors of all time, and that would be Roberta Findlay. And with me today, first, we will be having Stephen Ronquillo will be joining us later. He had something he had to do, but he'll call in as soon as he gets back. But with us right now is one of our favorite people on podcast, film historian from Oklahoma City and just great all-around guy, Patrick Crane. Patrick, nice to have you with us.
Well, it's great to be here again. Thank you, Carl. Always, always, always a pleasure.
Absolutely. So one of the reasons we started this or have you on is you have your own little blog that you do, the Apollo Twin, and you've been focusing specifically, as you usually do, you usually focus on one film director, on Roberta Findlay. So I'm just going to toss it to you and give us a little background on Roberta and, of course, her marriage to Michael Findlay and how that all came about and how you became interested in them.
Well, my initial interest with the Findlays probably came from my fascination with the movie Snuff. And it was Michael Weldon's Psychotronic Encyclopedia of Film, which sort of informed my knowledge of Snuff, and it wasn't something that was readily available for me to see until DVD came along. And I think it might have been on VHS, but it wasn't anywhere in my vicinity. But when I finally saw Snuff, I was really fascinated with the movie that was made, you know, without the tacked-on ending. But again, it was not real easy for me to see a lot of the movies that the Findlays had made, and it was really hard for me to even find out what they had made because this was all pre-internet stuff. But eventually, I became fascinated with her and, you know, how she had this career with him, found a way to break away from him, break ahead of him, physically and professionally, and be this one-woman force in this pretty much male-dominated industry of hardcore pornography in the 70s and early 80s, and then to stick her landing, making these low-budget horror films that are, you know, still pretty, they're decent, you know, given their budgets, and they're unique. I became fascinated with her story and her narrative. And so I've been filling in, you know, that narrative by watching her films as I've been able to, you know, get my hands on them. And, you know, again, when you're dealing with a director that does hardcore pornography, a lot of that stuff is not easily found or easily available. A lot of that stuff is lost, or the prints that are available or the transfers that are available are from compromised prints that were cut in certain regions that may have found some of the material objectionable. So, you know, what you can get your hands on is not always the full picture, but it's just a fascinating, you know, journey into Roberta Findlay. And then, you know, of course, by extension, Michael Findlay, who was the one who sort of began the filmmaking journey with her. But do you want me to go into their story as I know it?
Yeah, go ahead because this will give us a little background on how this all started. One thing is when we get back, I've got a story about Snuff. Okay, so
oh,
go
right.
ahead, but give
yeah.
us the information.
Right. Yeah, no, I know your story about Snuff, and I do. I love that story. So yeah, so Roberta and Michael Findlay, Roberta and Michael Findlay. I can't remember the age difference, but there was a certain age difference. But she was very smart, went to college early, and that's where they met. And she was like 16, And he ran a film program, and she was a pianist, and that's what her major was. And so he asked her to do piano accompaniment to silent film that he was showing. And that's how they sort of met. And then she moved in with him, and then I think that's when, of course, they got married. And he worked at ABC, and he met one of the Amaro brothers. I can't remember which, Lou Amaro, what's the other Amaro brother name? But anyway, they made a movie called The Body of a Female, right? Body of a Female.
Right.
And that actually had Roberta in it, in front of the camera. And that film is lost. And it's unfortunate because it's Michael Finley's debut film. It's been lost for some time. And it's, of course, a value because then, of course, it's an early look at Roberta, who, she was really quite a smoke show back in the day, Roberta was. But she was started off in front of the camera, and then Michael went on after he left, they remained friends. They had a little bit of a falling out, I think, because Michael believed that one of them had designs on Roberta, and that really wasn't the case because he was gay. And so Michael then begins to make his own movies by himself, and he starts off with The Sin Syndicate, which is a really kind of a pastiche of a bunch of stock footage from the London raids in World War II and the Cuban Revolution, and he sort of like spins this tale of all of these dejected women that work for a crime syndicate. He follows that up the same year with Satan's Bed, which is that's another pastiche movie that he makes with where he took an existing film that he purchased that was unfinished with Yoko Ono in it and Val Avery, and he stitched on an additional parallel story about these three miscreants that are looking for drugs, and he released it as Satan's Bed, and it's not really good. But then he makes Take Me Naked, which is the movie that he makes with Roberta, and I think that's like 1966. And she's here's where things get a little strange. She's in Satan's Bed. She's in that movie. She plays the woman in the beginning that's tied up to the pool table, and she gets a credit, I do believe, for lighting, and it's important to note that at this point, they both use pseudonyms. His generally is Julian Marsh, and hers is Anna Riva. But he also takes other pseudonyms, like Richard Jennings, which is a character that he plays in the Flesh trilogy, and that's all other thing. And then as she gets into hardcore, she takes different pseudonyms, most of which are male names, like Robert Norman is one of her pseudonyms. But while they're working together, they sort of form a production company called Riva Marsh, which is a combination of portmanteau of their two pseudonyms, last names.
Right.
And they make Take Me Naked, which is a movie where she is again in front of the camera, and it's a strange one. Have you seen that one?
Okay, I'm going to interrupt for a moment, and Stephen now is with us, Stephen Ronquillo, so I'm going to bring him in. Stephen, are you there?
Hello, everybody.
Hey, there he is.
Hello, Stephen.
So Stephen, we were at, it was Take Me Naked, right?
Yeah, I'm up to Take Me Naked. You want to go back and fill in on anything? I'm up to Take Me Naked at this point.
Cover
Steven?
The Ultimate Degenerate yet?
No, we're getting to that one. That's after the Flesh trilogy. We're just at their.
But that's
just
also the only movie they made twice. The first with the Amaros, and the second after the Amaros got tired of their domestic squabbling and said, have a nice day.
Is that what happened with the Ultimate Degenerates?
Yeah, it was a remake. I forget which one it was.
It's a remake kind of Take Me Naked, isn't it? Isn't it a little bit?
Yeah.
Or is it a
yeah.
It's sort of, yeah, it's from the female point of view, which I found there's an interesting thing that happens in their career that I'd like to talk about, where it seems that she starts to take over. And she starts to take over, like, artistic control and sort of break away from him. And that happens around a thousand Pleasures, I think it starts, after the Flesh Trilogy or at the end of the Flesh Trilogy, and sort of kind of goes on. Because in the rest of the movies, I mean, like, he suffers, like, pretty horrible fates at the end of each one of them. But, Take Me Naked is good. It's interesting. It drags a little bit, but it's kind of a proto-horror film in a way. And that's another thing that I think the Finleys sort of accidentally stumble upwards and invent with the Flesh Trilogy especially, which is kind of the horror franchise that we sort of now know in a way. Because, I mean, in the Flesh Trilogy, where we're dealing with the character of Richard Jennings, who is a cuckolded husband who sees his wife, played by Angelique Pettijohn, who I didn't even recognize, in bed with some backdoor man. He goes nuts, runs out in the street, gets hit by a car, loses an eye, you know, gets put in a wheelchair, and vows bloody revenge on every woman that, you know, his wife, and then every other woman that draws breath. But in these three films, they sort of establish what we see in the 80s in these kind of slasher franchises, where what we care about are the gags in which Richard Jennings is going to dispatch these women. It's like watching Jason. You know, he's going to take a blowgun into a strip club. You know, he's going to poison a cat's paw and then get that cat to scratch a lady in this very convoluted Rube Goldberg kind of, you know, scenario. But I love how...
And don't forget how funny the Flesh movies are.
Oh, they're hysterical.
Oh, my God, yeah. His dialogue
is amazing.
I
didn't say funny, I said punny.
Oh, I thought you said funny. I was like, well, his dialogue's funny for sure. The way he strangles dialogue makes me laugh.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Stephen.
One of my favorite bits is where they're talking about the girl's cat. And she's like,
it
comes over every day with the neighbor woman.
Right. And he's talking about how I bet, you know, you like, y'all like to rub your pussies together and it would swallow all my meat. It's so awful. And I mean, it's groan inducing, but it's also so funny because, you know, Michael Finley's voice, I said this on Twitter today. I said, I would crawl through broken glass to listen to the both of them read a phone book. Because I love both of their voices. They have such distinctive voices
I can do that
give me joy.
In that movie, you know, those scenes what? Came in the restroom the other night, and they were committing a perverted act. Well, what did they do? They asked me to join them. Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're here.
Oh, I didn't. Okay, I didn't. I didn't know. I didn't know there was more. I thought there might have been more to that.
but
I don't know.
You know. Okay, let me come in here. One of the things about that I really I liked about Flesh, because Stephen had me on for a commentary watch, and it was just. It was surreal. My mouth hit the fucking floor. Seriously. I mean, all I can remember is, you know what this is? it's a dildo. It's a girl's best friend. And that's when he's giving a dildo with the switchblade in it. It's like, God, just insane.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's, you know, Michael Finley was not probably a well man by all accounts. And these films were sort of a kind of therapy for him. I don't know how healthy it was, but I mean, these things were, you know, when you watch them, I mean, he's a very particular type of person. And I think his, you know, imposing personality, I think Roberta's films are almost a reaction to having lived and dealt with Michael for the first, you know, X number of years of her adult life.
You know, was the relationship between them violent at all, do you know?
She says that it wasn't, I mean, a couple of times I think it got a little out of hand, but she also says that she provoked him. And, you know, they were both, I think, you know, in a way, I don't know, it seems like they were both equally good and bad for each other. I mean, at the same time, you know,
left is because of that back and forth between them. They couldn't even work with them anymore. They were so desperate to work with them that when they had their child, they would babysit for them just in hopes that they would get their poop together.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and then, you know, and so when she, I mean, when she... She just left him because I think, you know, she probably had a little bit of wanderlust and you know, probably felt that she had gotten hooked in a little early and there was more life out there. And I think he also had a lot of issues that were really hard to overcome, too, because, again, these movies are not from the mind of somebody that's well, especially given the repetitive nature of sort of the violence in them. I mean, they're all pointed to women. And what's funny is a lot of times when you're watching it, you know, it seems like a lot of this is just sort of like he's subtexting his relationship to Roberta specifically.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's obviously for the best that union did not last any longer.
Well,
than it
in
did.
The
Merrill course...
book, all they said was that he had issues he was trying to work out in his films, but he never did. And that's all I'm saying about that.
Yeah, right. What I mean, you know, like, I... Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say very quickly, you know, when you take a look at the Flesh trilogy and you look at some of the others, we have to just make a delineation here. You know, you started with the nudie cuties and that, but really when you get to Flesh, would you, you know, that to me is a real roughie, what we call roughies. And though I don't think Finley started that, you know, this is where he is. And then, of course, you know, when they started, it was more along the lines of the nudie cuties and that sort of thing. So, when you get into this, it's rough on the women that are starring in it, and I would think that would have a real
effect. Why did the Defilers come out?
Not sure. 60.
Oh, it's not asking you, Carl.
Oh, okay.
The Defilers.
Oh, I don't know.
Because that was the first roughie, and it pretty much changed the game.
I thought Scum of the Earth was, the Herschel Gordon Lewis movie.
Yeah, but that only has like a minute. But really, after that, when Friedman went out to the West Coast, that's when he started that up, and they seen that they can make a lot of money off of it.
Right, okay, sure. But what's nifty about the Flesh trilogy, too, is you get to see those censorship laws fall really quickly, because what you're able to get away with in the first one versus what you can get away with in the third one is decently vast, and we're only talking about a period of less than 52 weeks. You know, it's less than a year. You've got these three movies coming out all in the span of a 12 month period, and you get to watch how fast those censorship laws move. Because I mean, like in the first one, it's really only waist up and boobs and butts. But boy, by that third one, you know, you've got Wilson from Home Improvement getting anal beads yanked out of his ass and all kinds of crazy shit.
And the incident with the lobster claw.
Yes, right. Yeah, the lobster claw and the electrocution on the, you know, I mean, it's a plus trilogy gets pretty wild. So, you know.
And if you're trying to get it nowadays, for now, try to download it, because all of the Something Weird collectors has made it insane price-wise.
Yeah, that's true. And if you do want to get it on DVD, I would strongly suggest looking for the Something Weird triple feature that's on one disc. Because I had those DVD-Rs that they put out of those three movies, and the quality is vastly noticeable between the two. So the triple feature on one disc is like it's the way to go if you can find it.
And the best way
to
tell is that if you get it from Something Weird and it's one of those cheap plastic cases, you don't even have to watch it to know that it's one of their DVDRs.
Yeah, they're also within this, the context of this conversation, they've also put out DVDRs of Nasadika, which is their first color film, and it's the first film Roberta actually copped the shooting, even though she probably shot at least some of the third Flesh film. But Nasadika is the first film she actually admits to shooting. But anyway, the Something Weird DVD-R of it is absolutely horrible. And that's a shame, too, because it's a gorgeous-looking movie. It's well shot. And also on top of that, their DVD-R of The Clam Digger's Daughter, which is the a Roberta Finley film from, like, I think, 73, 74, is also equally worthless. Horribly cut up, almost indecisible.
Well, that's such all a shame. That the company would let them put out. I mean, they had The Lustful Turk. It was done. They didn't put it out. Love Camp 7. It was done. They would allow them to put out The Sinful Dwarf.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know that in some cases they can only put out what they have. You know, they get a hold of a print, and it's you know, and it's edited and whatnot. But in The Clam Digger's Daughter, it's almost like they shouldn't have even bothered, because it is really hacked up. I don't know where they got that print from. They obviously got it from some projectionist in some region that had really cut out some of the guts of those sex scenes. I don't know if that film had any hardcore in it, or if it was just a softcore film, but the print that they used for their transfer is really cut up pretty badly.
It was found in the infamous warehouse that Varney, the guy who owns A.T. Lewis Films, and Ken and Lauder bought.
That was the one up in Boston.
Yeah. Right? That was in Boston, wasn't it?
Yeah, they got Boston a call and said, okay, we got a warehouse, and there's over like 3,000 films in here, and the owner of the warehouse is just going to throw them in the garbage and let you buy them within the next week.
Nice.
That's wild.
That ain't the funniest thing. The funniest thing is, Henlotter found the original negative to Blue Sunshine in that warehouse.
That's wild. That's a great movie. I'm a huge fan.
That is a great movie.
Absolutely. Love that film.
But, yeah. But, so, yeah, I mean, there's sort of a point where she and Michael's relationship begins to deteriorate. I think Snuff is the last thing they work on together as a married couple. I mean, she comes back to shoot Shriek of the Mutilated in, I guess, 74, but Snuff in 71, or Slaughter as it was originally titled, was the last movie I think they made together, right? Or is,
yeah.
Did, yeah, because Janie is before that, right? That's 1970.
Yeah.
And Janie,
well,
the director,
the story
is, and the credit,
is that the person who produced Slaughter in San Francisco used her like Doris Wishman's last producer used her.
Oh, I didn't see. I didn't. I thought that. Well, she was, because the Snuff was done. I mean, it was right. It was shot as Slaughter, and then Paramount, they shelved it. Paramount bought the title from them, and then Alan Shackleton took it, who she actually had a relationship with later. He took it and released it later with that additional footage tacked on to it, was my understanding of how Snuff came out in 77.
No,
and that additional,
we got the story
from
the horse's mouth.
Yeah,
that
go for it, Stephen. That's exactly where I was going.
Well, we had Carter
Stevens
on our show, and I jokingly mentioned it, and he told the whole story. He had bought the film, and the whole Snuff thing was like a controversy at the time. So he rented out Carter Stevens' loft, the House of Wayward Women, and he loaned him the use of his loft in the afternoon. So that whole scene filmed in Carter Stevens' loft.
Oh, okay. All right.
So if we're going on with Snuff, I think this is a good chance for me just to tell my little story about it. So I moved to New York in 1981 and got some contacts right away. A friend of mine called me up, and this is during the late spring or early summer of 81, and they had re-released Snuff at the Deuce. I'm one of the theaters that produced. And they hired my friend as a fake picketer. They also had the Snuffmobile going down 42nd Street and so on and so forth. So my friend said, hey, I got some tickets to this. He said, all you have to do is go through some fake protesters. I said, sure, I'll go in. Not a good movie, kids. I'm just letting you know. But it was
I first ran into it. I ran into it in Best Buy, and I was like, all right, it's Snuff. And then 3 seconds later, my mind went, see? And I went, oh, yeah, it's Snuff.
I'm a proud owner of Snuff. I love Snuff. I love it. I have it. I was watching it before I called in. I love it. And the reason I love it, one of the reasons I love it is because – It's the dubbing in it is so jagged. It's like a demented Peanuts cartoon and I love that one of those girls is obviously Roberta Finley, because her voice, that she has that Bronx honk she can't get rid of, and I love it when I hear it, and I can pick it out of a group of people. I just love her voice. And I love that one of those girls in that Manson gang has her voice. And then, of course, I love that Richard Finley shows up in it. Of course, I love his voice, too.
And now
the
quote of famous movie, and right now, after Snuff comes the sad and weepy part of this tale, as in, for Snuff, Finley had some new 3D techniques he was trying out. So we went on top of... Wasn't it the World Trade Center? Yeah.
No, with the Pan Am building. Pan Am building.
Yeah,
the Pan Am building to wait for his ride on top. And there was a horrible accident and he lost his head.
Literally.
Yeah, such a shame.
Actually, he wasn't. I heard he was. I think he was transected. Was what I thought I read, that he wasn't decapitated, but like he had severe lacerations because the helicopter tipped over and one of the rotors just, you know, broke off and flew right at him. And I think, you know,
if you want to look at any movie from the late 70s, early 80s, where they're landing on top of the big buildings like that, you will see how scary it is, people.
Isn't that where Superman, the big set piece in Superman takes place? Is that not shot on the top of the Pan Am building?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's where he died the year before, because that movie's 78. So maybe it was even shot before he died on that, you know, on that helicopter pad, because it's around
that
same time.
Snuff was shot in 72. The extra footage was shot in 78.
In Snuff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he died. I thought he died in like 77. Didn't he?
Yeah, I think it was 77, Stephen. In fact,
so what I'm
sure
saying, what I'm saying is that around the time that Superman is shot, because Superman comes out in 78, and I know that's got a huge long time production time. So, you know, Michael Finley's death on the top of the Pan Am building and Superman being shot in the same location is happening in and around the same time. You know, within a few months, it seems. It would seem to me.
Right.
So, you know, before or after. But anyway,
that was around the time that Roberta also shut down about Michael.
Right. Well, yeah, because she had come back to shoot Shriek of the Mutilated, and then that was it. After she was done with that, she was done with him, and that was the last time she ever saw him or spoke to him. And she had gone on.
Well, she did want to tell all the interviews and want to know, you know, in her dream, they didn't give a damn about my movies. Why should I give a damn about their questions?
Right.
Right.
You know, it's a shame that happened. But let's move on a little bit, and let's go back to Shriek, because we need to talk about Shriek the Mutilated. Yeah, go for it, Steven.
Popcorn.
Good God.
I don't know if it's out yet, but Vinegar Syndrome is putting out an uncut, unrestored version of it with popcorn.
Oh, wow. If you want
I just watched the Vinegar Syndrome. It's gorgeous. That transfer looks amazing.
You know, if you want a werewolf movie or a Bigfoot movie that is so out there it's not even funny, you know, Charles B. Pierce be damned, God bless, Shriek of the Mutilated is just one of the most insane things I've ever seen.
Well, Shriek of the Mutilated had the damn sense to realize they had a crappy outfit, so they changed the whole twist in the last third of the movie.
Right, yeah. But, you know, I'll tell you, it's not good in any conventional sense, but I do think it's got some really nice cinematography. She did a good job with those exteriors. I love that specific time that it's set in, that late fall, early winter. So it has a real atmosphere to it. And, boy, that Blu-ray sure is a revelation in terms of the quality, because when that Yeti is coming up the stairs, it's actually kind of creepy for the first time, because I'd seen this before really, really shitty transfer. But, you know, that moment is actually kind of creepy, and the movie is just so much fun. I mean, it's not good, but it's so much fun.
Yeah, okay, guys, I got to go. And I just want to say, right, the only one I'm really sad that I'm going to be missing is when you talk about Testament, the only movie to get X-rayed and went, okay.
Right.
Well, Stephen had to leave us, but of course it's not Testament, it's Tenement he's talking about. But we'll get there. We'll get there. So here we are. They've made the split, and we're basically at Shriek of the Mutilated and Snuff. Where do we go from here?
Well, after Snuff, it's where she goes and she starts making movies on her own. I believe the first one she does is Altar of Lust. But, what's funny is that one I think is supposed to be where I thought she and Michael had split. But Michael does the voice of the psychiatrist, the lead. It's a story about a woman on a psychiatrist's couch retelling the traumas of her life, and the psychiatrist is played by Fred Lincoln, but the voice is Michael Finley. So I don't know what the status of their relationship was, if they were not quite broken up or what, but. After Altar of Lust, she does a series of movies that are sort of like semi-softcore, semi-hardcore. They're really on that fine line, as the legality of it is kind of in that gray area. But once hardcore films are all the rage, she goes all in. Her first hardcore film, full hardcore film, is the 1974's Angel on Fire, also known as Angel Number 9. And it's a very interesting twist almost on The Devil and Miss Jones a little bit, where you have a male protagonist who is a real misogynist asshole who gets hit by a car, goes to heaven, and has to come back down to earth as in the body of a woman to earn his way into heaven. He has to learn a lesson. And the lesson that he learns in the body of the woman is he has to finally end up with an asshole misogynist as he was. And in the case in the movie, played by Jamie Gillis at the end. Angel Number 9 or Angel on Fire is really a great, great hardcore debut. And it's really, I think, inventive. I think it's fun. I think it totally belies this notion that she was not able to shoot hardcore. That's usually by her own standards. I think it's a wonderfully inventive film, imaginative, and I think she shows a great deal of flair in it. I love all the performances in it. And I think it's a really, really strong film. And from there on, she makes a string of hardcore films up through the 80s. I have not seen all of her hardcore films, but I've seen a number of them. And every single one of them that I've ever seen, I would say every single one of them is great, but every single one of them has a specific kind of sheen on them, professionalism. To them, and they're not like the kind of arty, rattly Metzger type stuff, or sort of the fun pop, sugar cereal cinema of Bob Chin. It's more New York filmmaking. Like I would put her in a class of New York filmmakers. Aside from being a hardcore filmmaker, she is a true New York filmmaker, like Sidney Lumet or Woody Allen or Martin Scorsese. She has a specific view of New York, and it's reflected in her work, and it comes through in all of her work. Even if that work is not like the best representation, like for example, Sweet Punk and I Love You, which is one of her hardcore efforts, is not great. But it still has a lot of things about it that fit into her style and that are true to her vision that I sort of love it. That's what you see that throughout all of her work. There is a unified kind of visual sense. She is a visually oriented filmmaker, and that was, in fact, what she really cared about hardcore was the cinematography. She was not at all that interested in the sex part of it. In fact, was not all that hot on it in the first place, but it's just something to do. But you know, her work is just very, very unique and very singular. And I hope more of it is discovered. I hope more material, or the original materials, are discovered, and they're able to sort of restore more of her work, because she's a very, very important filmmaker. And as we, you know, as we kind of get used to the fact that, you know, pornography is a legitimate subgenre in, you know, our culture, her work is going to get more and more elevated and scrutinized, and I think that is why more and more of it needs to be made available, if possible, because I think she's just one of the best.
Now, I'm going to interrupt here. Now, I can't remember who Stephen and I interviewed who said this, but it was a male porn star. I don't think it was Pacheco, but that seems to hit the background. It was Pacheco, he was in a couple of her films, and said she was the most professional director he ever worked with. And that she didn't have any trouble at all with the, you know, the male crew. You know, they listened to her, and she was very, very professional and did things, and that the look of the films were great. But that the work with the actors too, well, you know, she had a grittiness. She wanted, if it was a violent scene, she wanted more edge to it, and things like that. But you're right about the New York perspective and that sense of grittiness, because particularly I know her more for her horror films, which we'll get into a little later. But there was a real grittiness that belied the budgetary restraints and such. And you know, sometimes you got to work with what you got, and you may not have a lot, but she may not have a lot, but there's so many moments that are diamonds in her films because of the work that she did. So keep going, Patrick. Forgive my voice, by the way.
Yeah,
guys.
Yeah, definitely. I think of her as a street level filmmaker. Like, she's really, because, like, and again, I think I've said this before on this show, that pornography really is kind of the independent of the independent filmmaking. I mean, here, it's not just that you've got a tight budget. At least in some parts of the country, you may go to jail for what you're shooting. So, you know, there's a real risk in this stuff. And in fact, Roberta Finley did get busted for, she shot All in the Sex Family. I think it was one of the Amaros, actually, again. I think it was one of their films, maybe. I'm not sure on this, but she shot that film, and she ended up getting busted with Jamie Gillis and, you know, a bunch of others. And anyway, you know, that went through the court system, eventually got dismissed. But, you know, I mean, there's a built-in sort of integrity in hardcore pornography. If you're making it for a general audience, you're not just making, you know, these loop carriers or whatever. And those have their place. But when you're out trying to tell stories and actually try to make something that is, palatable and will have some kind of lasting value, what they did was very, very, I think very, very important. But we talked about A Woman's Torment, right?
Yes. Which,
right.
I do
so
know.
Like,
I
you
know.
That's a good bridge from her, you know, hardcore stuff to her horror stuff. Because, you know, I always felt that what she did with Michael early on was, you know, kind of akin to a certain kind of horror film. I think from Take Me Naked on, and even parts of Satan's Bed, at least his parts of Satan's Bed, the stuff that he filmed, I think has kind of a horror vibe to it. But, you know, so that was the horror vibe kind of goes through a lot of their work together, up through Snuff, obviously, and Shriek of the Mutilated. But then, you know, A Woman's Torment is really, I think, one of her strongest pieces. And it's a kind of a hardcore riff on Repulsion in a certain kind of way. And I think that movie, if you want to see a movie where that mixes that kind of taboo type of subgenre, which is hardcore pornography, with a very thought-provoking character study that's really exquisitely acted by everybody involved and really super well-made and well-shot, A Woman's Torment is really a great, great film. And it's, I think, one of her best films. And Vinegar Syndrome did a really nice Blu-ray of it that contains both the hardcore cut and the softcore cut. And in my opinion, I like the softcore cut better. I think it's a better film because it has actually more character development between some of the cast. And I think, by the way, the person that said that she was the most professional one he'd ever worked with, I think might have been Robert Kerman, Arbola.
That's who. No, it wasn't. Kerman. We never did Kerman. We had a chance to talk to Kerman.
So this was somebody actually you had on. Okay.
Yeah.
Because I know that
absolutely.
Kerman spoke very highly of her. And I think maybe his first film was with her. I think Anyone But My Husband might have been his first film. And it was with her. And that's one of her great, great hardcore films from the early or mid-70s.
But by the way, I want to do a shout out on A Woman's Torment. The lead character who was portrayed by Tara Chung, who I do not know, but she's phenomenal in that film.
Yeah.
She's
a one and done. Well,
yeah.
She's actually kind of a two and done, right? She made that, and then she made the Caboose movie, The Beach House, that they sort of traveled together, I think, out of the outtakes. But yeah, she wandered off in the middle of the shoot with one of the gaffers, and so some of the reverse shots of her are actually Roberta Finley in a black wig, because Tara Chung was unavailable and they couldn't get any of the reverse shots done because she wandered off, and that's a damn shame because she is, like you said, absolutely phenomenal in that movie. She's a great actress, and she has a real presence as a sex performer. You know, she can do both, and it's a really striking performance. And you know, I highly recommend A Woman's Torment. I think I think it's one of her best films.
Agreed. I happen to see that like as a third feature at a porn theater. It wasn't on the Deuce. It might have been the Essex. I'm not sure, up in the Bronx. Or it might have been the Broadway in Astoria. But I saw that, and I said, God damn, this is a good movie. Holy shit. Seriously.
Yeah, it's really good. I mean, she always surprises. Another great Vinegar Syndrome release of hers is Mascara, which it's credited to Henri Pichard, Ron Sullivan, but he only directed the hardcore scenes. But the rest of the movie is directed by Roberta Finley, and it's a truly great, great character study film. And it's one of her last last hardcore films before she moves over to horror, because she ends up making a movie with Shauna Grant called Shauna, Every Man's Fantasy. No, it's called Glitter. I'm sorry, she makes a movie called Glitter. And then Shauna Grant kills herself, and then Roberta Finley makes a movie that kind of exploits the death of Shauna Grant. She cobbles it out of outtakes, out of Glitter, and calls it Shauna, Every Man's Fantasy. And it's of course, you know, in such poor taste that everybody sort of like dogs it. And at this point, you know, the adult industry, this is the mid-80s, it's moving into VHS and video, and she and her partner at the time, Walter Sear, the producing partner, and they were also a couple, they don't want any part of the VHS. That whole distribution cycle is different. It was different, you know, than theatrical release. So they didn't really want any part of that. And so they just moved their action over to horror films. And the first one, I think they start with, is Tenement the first one, or is The Oracle the first one?
No, The Oracle is the first one. The Oracle is the first one.
Okay, so The Oracle. And I have not seen The Oracle, nor have I seen Blood Sisters. Those are the two I have not yet seen. I have them, but I have not yet watched them. We were waiting for this October, so we're waiting for this spooky season to watch them, so we're getting ready to watch them. But I've not yet watched them. I have seen Tenement, I have seen Lurkers, and I have seen Primeval.
By the way, I have to put out a little bit of a shout-out to Lurkers. I really like that movie. And it belies, again, it belies its budget. But it's, you know, the thing about her and her, you know, the plots are smart. These people aren't stupid. You know, a lot of, like, horror movies, the kids are stupid and stupid decisions. Not in this case. Not in this case. And, again, right. It's about, you know, it's about guilt. It's about, you know, she's haunted by flashbacks of her dead mother and dead people floating, and why is this happening? And you know, it's just, it's creepy as fuck. It really is.
Yeah. And I blind purchased both, you know, because Vinegar Syndrome put out a Blu-ray that has both of those movies on one disc. And I remember watching them and thinking, okay, yeah, these are low budget, but each one of them charmed me. And they were really sort of good of kind, and I could see, you know, that there was a lot of care in the way they were shot. And the other thing about all of her movies, talking about undermining, this whole notion of hers that she loves to go around talking about how much not a feminist she is. And, you know, this is her big shtick about how she's not a feminist. But you would,
right.
You know, she may say that, but you wouldn't know that from watching any of her movies. Because, like, every single one of her movies is, you know, it's the triumphant at the end, or is a woman, or it's specifically about, in like case, a woman's torment, specifically about women's issues. You know, and I can't speak for every hardcore film that I've seen, but say Mascara, very much about a woman's identity, you know, and again, we talked about a woman's torment. And again, Angel on Angel Number 9, it's about a misogynist who is, you know, his punishment is to come down to earth and have to live life as a woman, be treated like shit by a man. I mean, it's just impossible to watch her movies and take that, you know, I'm not a feminist very seriously. I think she means something specific when she says that. But her movies, I mean, all even through her horror films, are very much pro-feminist.
Well, you know, she might say it's not pro-feminist, but it's certainly through a woman's eyes. You can grasp that right from the beginning, because she has a different take on women that is much more sympathetic than a lot of male directors and writers, particularly when you're in the horror genre.
Yeah. Right, which is what I mean when I say it's pro-feminist. I mean it's pro-women. It's, you know, it's about, you know, it's from that point of view. And that
right.
is, that's specific. That's not something that a man can really, you know, ape. Like, you know, John Cassavetes can get close, say, with Woman of the Influence, because, you know, that a lot of that is guided by Jenna Rollins probably talking to him and whatnot. But, you know,
right.
this is coming right from the source. And this is coming right from a person who, you know, lived a very difficult, she was in a very difficult marriage with a very difficult person. And at a young age, too, might I add. So, you know, that can't help but have impressed her worldview in some way, right? And it, you know, and that she emerges triumphant as this master technician and great storyteller. You know, is I think such a wonderful thing, and I'm glad that she is alive to see the recognition that she deserves. I know that she's, you know, by all accounts, very, you know, and by all, you know, you see this in interviews, you know, somewhat uncomfortable with that kind of adulation, but you know that somewhere deep down it can't help but touch her in a way that it did mean something to people, her efforts, and whether she meant them or not. You know, a lot of pioneers don't really mean to do what they do. You know, that's the thing, is that they don't, a lot of people just do what they have to do and they forge a path. They don't mean to, that's just what they have to do. And that's what she did. And, you know, I think she sort of, you know, she's, again, self-deprecating, but I think she also probably somewhere deep down realizes that, right? You think?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're almost at the end of the show. I just wanted to give you a couple more minutes to finish up about Roberta, and also to give you a chance to plug the Apollo Twin and everything that you're doing.
Okay. My final thoughts on Roberta Finley is just that she's, you know, like I said, she's great. I'm so glad that, you know, so much of her stuff is starting to become more available. Again, I hope more becomes available, because she's definitely worth diving into and studying. And I'm so grateful that this book by Edinburgh Press is coming out, that is an academic book that covers a great deal of her work and her career. And I think she might be the first hardcore director that series is covering. So that's quite a get, I think, because, you know, these books are very, very serious minded. And again, they're geared toward academia. So I'm glad that Roberta Finley is the first, I believe, filmmaker to get that on. And so this is a great time for her, and I'm such a fan, and I can't say enough great things about her. And also, what I got to do today, give a shout out to Casey Scott, who is possibly going to call in. It's his birthday today, so happy birthday to Casey Scott. Casey Scott is the Roberta Finley whisperer. He does all of the commentaries with her on all the Vinegar Syndrome releases, conducts Q&As with her, and he is done a lot, I think, to help educate, especially myself, but others, on just what a great, great filmmaker she is and what a special and unique character she is. I think he is doing such great work in promoting her work and other filmmakers as well, but especially Roberta Finley. And so shout out to him. But back to the Apollo Twin, which is the thing that I do. Again, I do. I try to do weekly essays on individual films by certain filmmakers. Right now, I'm working on a series by Michael Mann. Every Monday, I release a new Michael Mann piece. So this coming Monday should be Miami Vice, the theatrical film from 2006. And on every Friday, I'm trying to release a Roberta Finley, Michael Finley essay. And tomorrow, maybe, hopefully, should be my essay on the Flesh trilogy. So I'm growing in chronological order with both. So I'm kind of way early in the Finleys, kind of way late in the Manns. After that, I don't know what I'm going to end up going back to, but that's what I'm working on right now. And all of that stuff can be found at apollotwin.com.
All right. Well, let me just go over a couple things, what we're doing now, what we like to call housekeeping. And at this point, tomorrow, Adam Ferenc is going to be doing the Catholic Brave Mission, and we'll be doing the films of Richard Linklater, and I'll be on that panel. On Monday, we continue, well, actually on Sunday, I take that back, we've got Rock This Town with TC. However, TC will be gone as he is apt to do, and he'll be attending another concert. So I'm going to be stepping in for TC and doing the radio show, and we're going to be doing Noah's Rock Art Carl's Cuts, and it's all going to be songs about animals. And we're going to have people like Ninja Sex Party on there, Jethro Tull, The Kinks, all sorts of good stuff, Ike and Tina Turner. So definitely want to check in for that. Now, on Monday, we are doing a back-to-school commentary watch. We're going to be doing that with Josh Buckland, and we're going to do the great Lindsay Anderson film, If, which is Malcolm McDowell's premiere debut in film, and just an incredible fuck you to the British class system and their education system. And then I could tell you also that on Thursday of next week, we will be very, very happy to have back with us author Danny Perry. And Danny's a good friend of the group and the podcast group, and we'll be very, very happy to have him back too. And of course, if you don't know who Danny Perry is, forgive me, I got a bit of sinus today. Danny Perry wrote all the cult movie books back in the 80s. And really fine cinephile, and also writes lots of sports books too. And we always talk a little bit about that too when he comes on. So that's what we have coming up this week. Patrick, I'm going to thank you very, very much for being on with us. Any last things to say before you go?
I think that's all I have right now. I think I've run my mouth enough. But, yeah, no, thank you very much for having me on.
And by the way, I'll be in touch, but let's try to get you on a little more regular. We've missed you, by the way. So,
oh, yeah, I missed being on. We'll whatever you got, let me know.
Well, you know, whatever you got, you can let me know, too. Okay? Seriously. If you got something you want to talk about, let me know, man.
That's true. I will. I'll send you stuff. I got stuff to talk about. I like to shoot my mouth.
Okay, cool. All right. So right now, we're going to say thank you very much for being with us. And I think we're going to say good night. Good night, everyone.
Good night.